Welcome to Boss Man Show. Special guest for you guys, Mo Williams, new coach of the Alabama State Hornets out of the SWAC Conference. Coach Williams, man, how you doing, man? How you doing, man? You got into yesterday, man. How do you feel so far, man, being an Alabama State Hornet, man?
I'm excited. I'm ecstatic. You know, all those words that mean the word excitement is balled up into one. Can't wait to get started. You know, can't wait to, you know, get on campus and do what I do.
Man, I hear that, Coach. Now, you know, how did it make you feel, man, when the University of Tabs used to be the head coach? You know, you worked with Coach Godfrey for 2 years out there at Cal State Northridge. You know, you learned under him, a great guy as well. And now you've been out in NBA 3 years, and now you're a head coach. So how does that make you feel, knowing where you went from retirement 17 now to coaching with Coach Godfrey now to being the head coach now? This whole process, man, how does it make you feel that this university said, hey, Mo Williams, we want you to be the guy to lead us going forward?
Well, what it means is, you know, when you set a goal and you put it in the universe, there's nothing that can't be obtained. That's another teaching point, you know, experience that I give kids, you know, and that I give my kids, you know, at ASU. Just that simple fact of, man, listen, you can obtain any goal you set forth to, but you got to do the proper thing and take the right steps to get and reach that goal. And that's what I did. You know, this just didn't come about. I didn't just wake up one day and say, hey, I want to be a head coach. No, this was years of preparation, years of putting it in the universe, years of doing the little thing to put myself in the position to be a head coach so early in my career.
Kind of led me to my next question, Coach Williams, is that how'd you go about prepping to be a coach? When did you kind of get that bug in your head that, hey, I might want to coach after my NBA day is over?
Well, that was my third year in the NBA. It was 2005, and I actually volunteered, you know, just to do it because he was a friend of mine. His son was pretty good. He was 14 years old in the eighth grade, and the kid I'm talking about ended up going to the University of Carolina, and he's overseas right now playing, had a little stint in the NBA. But rewinding that, you know, I started in 2005. It was a 14U AAU team, and we took them around the country to these tournaments, and I really enjoyed it. That's where my bug started. And then a few years after that, I started my own youth program in Texas and Mississippi and doing camps and doing all kind of things and had my program over 150 kids. And I have over 50 kids at the Division I level now. I have seven guys that came through my program that's in the NBA. And I coach those guys every summer, you know, from 2010 all the way up to my retirement. Every summer when guys was season was over, they was in the Bahamas, they was in Dominican Republic, they was in Hawaii. Shoot, I was on the first flight back to Dallas to coach my teams. So I was preparing for this moment.
Most definitely. You played with some great coaches in your career. You got a lot of different schemes in your head, probably a lot of different principles that you might want to teach. So taking all the knowledge that you have, Coach Williams, how do you see yourself kind of bringing it all together, condensing it to kind of make it easy for your players to comprehend and play the way that you want to play come this season?
Well, for one, to kind of dumb it down a little bit, because I can talk about that all day, philosophy and all that type of stuff. But just to dumb it down, you have to – understand what do you have on your roster, and you got to understand what's the best way to get things accomplished that you're trying to get accomplished. First thing is just setting your foundation. Your foundation is the most important. Developing the right culture, getting the right kids in, doing the right thing, and that's all off the court things. It's important that off the court activity, meaning academics, meaning how they carry themselves character wise, it carries over to the court. That's how you become a very, very good team, when you have a good culture and you have a good group of kids.
Most definitely, Coach. And I think, let's miss a lot about coaching is the play development piece, Coach. Cause I feel like development of players is so key to the success of a team, because guys who don't play have to still develop to help you out, because injuries happen, things happen in life, and guys are out. So having a great bench, having guys who are developed and confident in their games and getting better daily will help you when it comes to February and March trying to make that push, because guys get tired and get hurt, and you need guys who can step in and help you at a moment's notice.
Hey, I agree with you 1,000%, and that's what it's all about, developing them, not just on the court. Like I said, you know, I'm going to echo what I just said. You know, off the court is very important. That's where the start is. And you know, you get those kids to understand the development is not just on the court, not just getting in the gym 3 hours a day and you feel like you're developing. Yes, you're developing on the court, but it starts off the court. It starts with your mentality. It starts with how you carry yourself. It starts with what you're putting in your body. It starts with how you mentally preparing yourself each and every day to be better than you was yesterday.
And you're so right about that, Coach Williams. I feel like that's so key because, you know, I would see rookies with the Atlanta Hawks come in who did not know how to be professional, how to take care of their bodies, and how to prepare the right way, prepare themselves off the court. And for college kids, you know, it's a really a big picture. You want to get the education too as well, play ball as well, but become a better husband, a father, a man, because basketball is on any one day. You got to be a society. And having a coach who can help you become a man, turn into a model citizen going forward, is so key to any young man's success going forward in their lives. So having a college coach like you who noticed it will help these young men in Alabama State, I feel like, going forward for sure.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
And now, Coach, I want to ask you about this, man, for as the recruiting piece of it, man. You know, Alabama State, man, in the SWAC Conference, Alabama is a great position to kind of get guys – Georgia, Mississippi, where you're from, Tennessee, Kentucky, Louisiana, Texas, not that far away. So if a wide net to get young men. So what would be the typical young men you want to have in your program to help build this thing from the ground up that you're going to build here at Alabama State?
Well, like I said, it goes back to the foundation and the culture. You know, you get guys, A, want to be there, B, that are great kids, you know, and want to be successful and want to do it on and off the court. As simple as that.
Most definitely. I got you on that. Now, also, how's it been talking to your guys, man? I know it's not hard. It's kind of hard with COVID-19. You can't really be on campus. Zoom conferences, FaceTime. And so how's it been getting know your roster here the last week or so here?
Every day. We're in communication with our guys every day. Obviously, COVID-19, it is what it is. Everybody is in the same boat, so it ain't just us. So it's just about doing things a little different, being able to adjust. It's no different from coaching. You know what? You come into the game with a game plan. You know what? When you get hit in the mouth, you better be ready to adjust.
Amen. You got that right. I feel you on that, both definitely. And also, Coach, this is another piece of it. Being an HBCU, helping our young black men become successful black men in this world. So how's that, having that also on your plate to help our young black men become better black men going forward as well? Because I know HBCU, that's very important for our young men to grow and be great, great, great young men.
HBCU is historically black college. And that word is in there, black. So majority of the students would be African-American. With that being said, obviously that touches me because these are kids that come from the same place that I come from. If I wasn't the number one point guard in the country coming out of high school and I was just a player that's looking for a Division I scholarship, you know, I could have been one of those guys too in the same boat. And historically, you know, the big-time coaches that can have a real good impact in your life, they're usually at Power Five conferences or high major or high mid majors. So the opportunity for the knowledge that I've gained out my life, I couldn't ask for a better opportunity to be in a situation. Meaning that we're talking about the topic of helping African American kids, but not only that, it's every kid that is in my program, no matter what race, no matter what color, no matter what background. If they're part of my family, they're going to be a part of my family for life. And that's what I tell kids and their parents when I'm recruiting them right now. This is not just coming here and going to school and he did his job, I did mine. This is a lifelong relationship. You know, this you're trusting me to make this kid that you're sending me into a man when he leaves, because he's going into the real world when he graduates. So my goal is to get these kids graduated, but most importantly, have them mature enough and their character at a certain point where they can go into the real world, whether they're blessed to play somewhere professionally or not. They'll be prepared to go into the real world and go get a job and be able to function in life.
Most definitely. And also, Coach, I want to talk to you about scheduling. That's a big part of coaching. Besides recruiting, you got to schedule as well. So I know in the SWAC conference, you guys have to play guarantee games, raise money for the university. Outside of those guarantee games, Coach, how do you feel like you'll go about scheduling for your team? What do you do? Try to schedule them tough or play a non-exempt tournament? How do you see you going about kind of getting your young men some great experience before you get in a SWAC play there in January?
Well, that's the whole thing. You know, you want to get the experience. You want to be ready for conference play. That's important. We have to do well in conference. You know, our goal is to win the conference. Our goal is to win the conference tournament, go to the tournament. Those are our goals. So whatever we got to do scheduling-wise to prepare us for that, we will do that. We will play the right teams. We will do all those things to get prepared.
And what are your thoughts as a SWAC as a whole? Because I know the league is tough from top to bottom. A lot of great coaches. Sean Woods, the Dame Byron Smith out there. I got Dylan Howard up there at Alabama A&M, man. A lot of Johnny Jones at Texas Southern. A lot of tough coaches in that league, man. How do you think of the league from top to bottom from team 1 through 10 there?
Well, you know what? I respect the league. And that's the reason I was so intrigued with the position that opened up at Alabama State, because I feel like you know, I grew up around the SWAC, so I've been watching SWAC all my life, and obviously I've always kept an eye on every conference, and SWAC is one of them. And I always say, hey, man, to play in the SWAC, you got to be tough for one, because there's a bunch of tough dudes that play in the SWAC. It's a tough conference. It's a really good conference. You got a lot of good teams. You got teams that can pop up and win at any time. All you got to do is the right culture and build the right foundation. You got a chance to win.
Most definitely. I got two more for you, Coach. Who have been some guys in your lifetime and your career as a player and as a coach that really helped you out, man, and gave you the kind of guidance you needed to become the man you are today to lead this program here going forward?
Well, I started with Mark Godfrey. You know, he recruited me when I was in ninth grade, 15 years old. I've been knowing him since then. Played for him and obviously coached with him when I was adult, and I was able to be around him at that point. So I got to give him a lot of credit, but it goes back to even when I was in Jackson, Mississippi, when I was 8, 9 years old, where a great, great friend of mine in James Wright recently passed over the past few years, but he had an integral part in me developing. He used to pick me up all the time, take the time out of his life, take me to the gym and take me to camps and do all these things while my parents working. So I owe him a lot. And then just going forward just in my career after leaving Alabama, going to Utah, playing for Jerry Sloan and Terry Stotts and Mike Brown, you know, all these guys that I played for, you know, has been an integral part in my development as a coach, just learning what they do that was successful, taking things that they were successful with that I played in that was successful, seeing things that don't work. You know, so that's the whole maturation process of your development, knowing what works and what you can take with you, knowing what don't work, where you had a trial and error in that situation, knowing, you know what, I wouldn't do it that way. You know, so you learn, you live and you learn. And I've had all those experiences in the last 15 years. So for me, I've taken a lot of things and developed my own style and my own brand. And at the end of the day, this is the moment. This is the moment where I can put my brand to work.
That's what I got for Coach Williams is. You know, I know you played a lot of times at Phillips Arena against the Hawks. So tell me, what's your finest memory of playing the Hawks at Phillips Arena, man?
Sweeping them 3 years in a row in the playoffs.
I watched you do it, too. Hey, his son put out like this, please finish him off. I don't want to go to Cleveland anymore. Let's go and get him done in 4, please. So, yes, I watched you do it, man. I'm like, yes, get it back on misery. I can have a summer now. Let's do it.
sweeping them 3 years in a row and enjoying them nice restaurants down there in the meantime.
Exactly. And you know what's crazy about when you all played us? It's like it's always a Cavs home game when you all played with LeBron, man. Like, it's not even a Hawks home. This is a Cavs home game. We just here. We just here, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, indeed. Coach Williams, thank you so much for your time today, man. Best of luck to you with this job. We'll talk to you again down the road, man.
Absolutely, man. Anytime. Appreciate it.
Anytime, folks. Mo Williams on the Boss Man Show.
My heart skips skipping the beat. You're not close enough, so that space between you and me, let's lose it. The way you're dancing, swaying to the music. Girl, that body and how you move it. Every time you cross my mind, girl, I lose it.
Alexa, play the Country Heat playlist.
Okay.
I don't think you know what you're doing to me. You got
my... With Amazon Music, a voice is all you need. Get tens of millions of songs. Download the Amazon Music app today.
All right, folks, back in the Boss Man Show from the show. Coach Steve Forbes here with me. He's now with the Wake Forest Demon Deacons. He'll be coming to Atlanta at least once a year to play Georgia Tech. We're glad about that. Coach Forbes, man, what's up with you guys over there in Winston-Salem, man, and in Deacon country?
Well, Boss Man, thanks for having me on. I know we tried to connect a couple times, and I messed up. And so I appreciate your patience. And, you know, we're hard at it over here. We're hard at it trying to, finish out the roster for this coming year and then obviously start recruiting the 21-22 classes the best we can. And so it's a different time during this pandemic, you know, and all the events that's going on in the world right now. It's made it for an interesting move, to say the least.
Yeah, Coach, we last talked on March 12th. I was in Nashville, and right before everything shut down, you know, I was talking, even head to the arena and Bridgestone Arena, and all of a sudden, within that hour talking to you, it was all over, man. So it was so weird. Like, so from going from the air to from that, so how did you feel being to the ETSU when it all went down with your players and your staff, and how did you all handle that as that all went happen so fast in March there?
It just—you're right, though. It happened so fast. Everything was changing minute by minute, you know, and nobody really knew what to expect. And you and I had a conversation about, well, maybe, you know, we may or may not play, and then bam, it was over. And you know, it was—it just happened so fast and so abruptly that, you know, we just the next day we said goodbye to each other, and you know, everybody went home, and except for a couple guys, and so it was a hard way to end it. You know, there was no finish to it, you know. And so, you know, we went through the next month and finished recruiting and signed some really good players. And then, you know, the second weekend that Jordan was coming on, I was getting ready to watch that. Phone rang and it was Wake Forest, you know. And then that Thursday I signed a contract to be the head coach. And, again, I had to say goodbye to my team at East Tennessee State over the computer, you know, on a Zoom call, and I hated that. That was just awful. I hated that I had to say goodbye that way. So it really is not the ending that you wanted, you know. We didn't get to play in the tournament, and I didn't get to say goodbye to him face-to-face.
Exactly. And, Coach, what I would say about your time at ETSU was you was the winningest coach in Tennessee for those 5 years you was there. And I told you this off the air in our own private conversation, I feel like you was going to get a job anyway. If it was no pandemic, someone's going to come get you anyway because of what you've done. I mean, the best record in Tennessee over the last 5 years, having 26 wins a year. You can't do that anywhere like that and not get a call-up sometime.
Well, you know, I've had some opportunities, Boss Man, up into this to the Wake job. I just never felt like it was the right job or the right fit or the right time or, you know, whatever the circumstances were. I knew that I had a really good job, and I've said this before and I'll say it again. You know, Greg Marshall taught me when I was at Wichita not to mess with happy. And, you know, we were really happy in Johnson City. Great place to live, great program, great friends. You know, and it wasn't like, you know, I was looking to make a move, and I didn't expect to get a call from Wake Forest when I did. You know, like you said, the pandemic, there really wasn't, you know, a lot of jobs open. And so when they did call me, you know, it was a surprise.
Oh, yeah, and I can only imagine trying to interview for a job over Zoom. I guess it happened via Zoom, maybe. And then getting faxed the contract via DocuSign, probably.
Oh, listen. Now, listen, it's the only time in my life, Boss Man, that I'm going to interview with a suit on and bare feet because I didn't have any shoes on. I had to put my suit on 5 times to Zoom. One time with Chris Paul and Tim Duncan. And then, that Thursday I drove over to Winston-Salem, and met with the president, Dr. Hatch, for an hour, and then went to the on campus and put my COVID mask on and signed my contract. So that was the first time I'd ever stepped foot on Wake Forest in my entire life. I'd never been here. And so, yeah, it was a fast process. It was a very inclusive process, but it was a little strange, just, you know, not having a lot of human interaction face to face.
No, definitely. And Joe Farris is a great job, a great community with Salem, very great community. I've been a few times for the tennis tournament they have out there right by the football field in mm-hmm. late August there. So I've been out there for that. So far, how's the city been treating you with what you've seen so far? And the administration had to be real key for you to come take this job because, you know, if you have a great business there, a great AD, and a great support staff around all those people to have a great team on the court as well.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, Wake Forest was looking for a really good fit, and I was looking for a really good fit, you know, and we found each other. And the community's been outstanding. The hard part's been not being able to get out in the community much because the state of North Carolina just opened up, I think, to phase two like a week and a half ago. And so up until this past week, I really haven't even been able to go to a restaurant or anything. Basically, what I've been doing is coming over from Johnson City on Monday and working all week in the office till Friday and then going back to Johnson City on the weekends just because there's not a lot open right now. But they're starting to open back up, and the reception's been awesome, you know, as far as the students and the fans and the community. We really just haven't been able to connect face-to-face, and, you know, hopefully soon we'll be able to do that as, you know, as this thing starts to kind of hopefully subside and we can get back to a little bit, I guess, of a new normal.
And I know you, Coach, you love to get out of the community. You like to promote and get out there. So I've noticed it's been hard for you not to be able to go see people, meet people, interact, because you need that to build a buzz on a program. I know you're good about that. I heard about how you did up there in ETSU from Penny Collins, my guy. So I know how you roll, Coach. It was like, something you get out there, you just can't do it right now.
No, I'm a relationship guy, you know, and I like being, you know, meeting people and getting out. And I learned a lot of that from Bruce Pearl. You know, when I was at Tennessee, Bruce was he was great at that, you know, getting out in the community and promoting the program, promoting the things that we were doing. And so I learned from that, you know, and we did a lot of that at East Tennessee State. And I think that's one of the reasons why four of the 5 years I was there, we led the league in attendance, you know, and we've got to get our attendance back in the Joel here. And, you know, we're going to get out there and work it. But, you know, the best marketing tool of all is winning, you know.
Yeah, they're right.
I mean, it ain't baby races and T-shirt contests, I can tell you that much. It's winning basketball games. And so, you know, that's what we got to do, man. We got to start winning and give people the hope, you know, and get them excited again to come back and watch us play.
And, Coach, you know how to build a program from being with Bruce Pearl and Greg Marshall and building ETSU yourself. So how do you see yourself going about attacking and building this Demon Deacon program the way it used to be when Tim Duncan was around and Chris Paul was around? So getting them back 2020 and above, with getting these guys going and that black and gold there, man.
Well, boss man, the very first thing I learned about recruiting is really good players make really good coaches. You got to get some players, you know, and that's the bottom. You know, we got some really good guys and younger guys in the program. We got them coming back, and, you know, I kept Randolph Childress as an assistant, and that really helped that situation. And, you know, he was an All-American here and a great player. But we got to get really good players so we can compete at the ACC level. You know, and that's the key. And then we just run our own race. You know, I don't think in a league like this, a Power Five league, you can't worry about everybody else. You got to run your own race. And that's where I'm at with it right now, is we just got to get better and get better and get better and not compare ourselves to other teams in the league, but just set a standard and go for it. And that's where I'm at with it. And there's no reason that this program can't compete and the ACC can't compete for championships. We have top 30, you know, education in the country. We have the ACC, and we have, like everybody in our league, we've got really good facilities, great facilities. And in fact, the guy that built this fabulous practice facilities from Atlanta, Mitch Shaw. He lives down there, and he's a tremendous supporter of our program. And so, we got all those things in line. We just got to get out there and work it.
It's so cool to know you're in the ACC now, the probably the best basketball conference in America, unfortunately, Tech is kind of middling, of course, but, a lot of great teams from the top of the East Coast down to Florida, Lynn Hamilton and Tallahassee. So how do you feel being about in this league, Coach, how the great coaches in this league, the great teams, man, and now you're a part of it, man. You're in the fire now.
Oh, let me tell you something. I'm from Lone Tree, Iowa. Okay, I graduated with 32 people. Do you really think when I turned on that first Zoom head coaches meeting about 4 weeks ago, and there was Coach K, Coach Williams, Leonard Hamilton, Jim Boeheim, Tony Bennett, Chris Mack, on and on and on and on, you think I was feeling real confident? No, I wasn't. It's a great feeling, though. I mean, you're in, like you said, historically, it's the best conference in the history of college basketball. And you got all kinds of Hall of Fame coaches. You got the best players. Why not? Why not want to be a part of something like that? We've had our own share of success, kind of like East Tennessee State. When I went there, they had a great run in the 90s with Mr. Jennings and Calvin Talford. And, they won a Greg Dennis. They won 4 championships in a row. They won 1 or 2 in the early 2000s with Tim Smith. And they won a couple maybe in 2010, and then they kind of hit a tough spot. It's the same thing with this program. I mean, I could go down, the lineage of NBA players that I've played here, we just got to give –
John Collins with the Hawks right now.
Yeah,
John Collins with the Hawks.
I mean, there's all kinds of, just great – Tim Duncan, Chris Paul, Josh Howard, Rodney Rogers, Ish Smith, John Collins. Al Farouk Aminu, on and on, right? I mean, Jeff Teague. I mean, they've had great players. We just gotta get back to those kind of guys and have a chance to win.
Most definitely. And Coach, what's good about your transition is you were able to keep your staff with you as well, which is very rare in this business. Mm-hmm. You able to keep most of your staff with you, except for Coach Shea, who stayed back to take over for you at ETSU. So how did it make you feel better to take your staff, like B.J. Mackey, with you, all your guys with you, who helped you build ETSU there?
Well, boss man, you can't talk about family and not live it. And every time we do something and we break a huddle, it's family on 3. 1, 2, 3. Family.
Family.
Well, you can't talk about family and then not treat people like family, And I didn't win it. I didn't win 130 games by myself at East Tennessee State. I had great assistant coaches and great people around me that had their fingerprints all over the program. And Coach Shea had a lot to do with that. And that's why he was rightfully so named the head coach at East Tennessee State after I left. And I took everybody else with me. I took B.J. Mackey, Brooks Savage, his full-time assistants. I took Frank Davis, another Georgia native from Gainesville. I brought him along with me as my dobo. I brought Mike Starkey as my strength coach, who was with me. I brought my son, Christopher, who was going to be my video coordinator there at East Tennessee State after getting his master's, is now going to be mine here. I'm going to hire Joe Hughley, who played for me last year as a player relations coach. I'm going to hire one of my former players, Brian Thomas Kamalauskas, played for me at Texas A&M, who has been in Europe for the last 12 years, playing a couple Olympics for Lithuania. So I've always been about family. I've always been about loyalty. And I'm not going to change just because I got a high major job.
Most definitely. I could give a commend you for that, Coach. And speaking of that, Coach, you kind of mentioned a little bit. How do you feel that you have a little bit of a tree now? You have Coach Shea at ETSU and my man Penny at Tennessee State. So who do you think a guy from Iowa would have a coaching tree the way you do now?
Hey, I'm from Lone Tree, man. Come on, that's my hometown. We're all about trees in my hometown. So I just thought of that.
Oh, definitely. Lone Tree, Iowa. Most definitely.
Hey. I got one tree, baby. And I got a little bud over there on the other side. But I'm proud of Penny. He's doing a great job there in Tennessee State. Got better, a lot better this year. Get even better next year. And Jason's gonna, have a great chance to have a really good team this first year in the SoCon. And both those guys worked really hard for their opportunities. And I'm really hopeful that BJ and Brooks and Randolph will get their shot someday here. And No, that's why you do it, to help other people. You want to help your players, and you want to help your assistant coaches do better in life. And so, yeah, I'm very proud of that. In fact, one of my other assistants from junior college, David Kiefer, is the head coach of Southeast Louisiana. So I really got three guys there.
Oh, yeah, Dave, yeah, he's a cool guy, too. I like you.
Yeah, Dave worked for me in Northwest Florida. And so really there's three guys, you know, over the last few years that have gotten their shot, and I hope to get more.
Most definitely. With Coach Forbes, I'm happy for you. Like I told you off the air, I'm happy for you, man. Look forward to seeing you at Georgia Tech this year. I'll stay neutral as I can because they won't throw me out. They won't throw me out.
It's all good. I appreciate you having me on. I know you've been loyal to me and through my career. And as I've, you know, worked my way up, you've been there, and I appreciate it. And you know, I just hope everybody stays safe. And you know, we're in some tough times right now, but we're going to get through them, and we just got to stay vigilant.
Most definitely, Coach. Thank you as well for coming on the show, man. I appreciate the relationship. I'm glad that you know you would still do this when you're at Wake Forest, because I will say, Coach, some coaches who I've had relationships with, they got bigger jobs. I don't hear from them anymore. I will say that.
You know, I get that head coach amnesia, right?
Yeah.
Hey, I don't forget. So, I ain't never going to forget.
So, yeah, thank you for not being there away, because I know some who have, and it's unfortunate, you know. But I'm glad for those who still stay true and loyal all the way through, and know I have your back as well. Say, wait, you have my back.
All right, boss, man, you have a good one, and look forward to talking to you soon, okay?
Go say, hey, Coach, when you're telling a recruit, let me know. Shoot me a text, and I'll come see you, man. Let me know.
All right, I'm going to be down.
All right, Coach, thank you as always, buddy.
All right, be good. See you.
All right.
It's maybe the night that my dreams might let me know. All the stars are closer. All the stars are closer.
Tell me what you're gonna do to me. Confrontation ain't nothing new to me. You could bring a bullet, bring a sword, bring a morgue, but you can't bring the truth to me.
Alexa, play Kendrick Lamar and SZA.
Okay.
Maybe the night that my dreams might let me know. All the stars are closer.
With Amazon Music, a voice is all you need. Get tens of millions of songs. Download the Amazon Music app today.
All right, folks, back in the jar of the Boss Man Show with Coach Lloyd Pierce, coach of the Atlanta Hawks here. Coach Pierce, first want to get started, man. How's everything with your family and your wife and children in Atlanta? And how have you been since the quarantine happened, man?
Thanks for having me on. Things are well with our family. We're safe. We're home. We're getting a lot of family time. That's been the one silver lining in everything.
Most definitely. You have a young daughter that's almost 2 years old, so getting to spend time with her has been very much probably a great thing for you right now. Not the way you want it to be, but getting to spend time with her and see her grow and develop and right there in person, in your face there.
Yeah, no, I got no complaints on that front. She's actually out in the pool right now, and it's great to just see her growth on a daily basis and a consistent basis. So I have no complaints with the family time.
Now, Coach, I saw you guys in Memphis. I was there at the game in Memphis on March 7th. And then my birthday, March 11th, everything kind of changed. You guys played the Knicks, and, you know, Vince made that best shot then for you guys, man. And just think about how our world has changed, Coach, since March 11th. And now we're here June 3rd, man. Just so could you ever dreamed up and imagined a scenario where our world has changed so much in less than 3 months right now, Coach?
Yeah, I mean, to say it's been a trying year is an understatement, you know, and I think especially in our league, you know, we start with the death of one of the greatest players to ever play this game, Kobe Bryant, and then the commissioner. So our league, we were deeply affected emotionally with those two occurrences. But I think as a country and as our world shifted with regards to COVID-19 and the pandemic and being sheltered in, you know, it really put us in a unique position all at once. And, you know, now I think, you know, the other issue that's come up with regards to racial discrimination and the police for African-American men, we're all forced to see something that has happened in our country over and over and over again. We're all forced to see it at the same time and together. And I think that's why we're in the position we've been in the last week or so. It's a response to something that's been a major problem for African-Americans for a very long time, and now we're having to deal with it, and the country's reacting.
And Coach, you made a post, said it could be just for Floyd, but just for Lloyd, a hashtag, and like, Coach, I'm with you. As a 33-year-old black man, I'm fear for my life daily. I move with a different motion than most because I don't want to get pulled over. That could be me. And you're an NBA coach. I'm a radio host. And that doesn't matter if we're both, other than that, we're both black men. And we're targets, unfortunately, in this world today. And it could easily been you or I instead of George Floyd. And aspiring out some more, Coach, because I feel like it's so important for us listeners to hear this here in Nashville, that we have a little bit different experience than most do. And we have to also watch ourselves and watch our movements, because anything we do can cost us our life just by living our normal life.
Yeah, and I agree. I've tried to avoid sharing the personal stories, whether it's myself or people that I know. I think the truth of the matter is I've been black for 44 years, and I've experienced this defense mechanism for as long as I can remember when it comes to how you're supposed to conduct yourself when it comes to law enforcement. It's just an association of fear that happens naturally. I don't even know when it started. I don't know, you know, what I've done or to equip myself with the proper response or reaction. But it's the fact that I have that fear, and so do most black men and black people in general, because of the systemic oppression that we faced, and because of the lack of communication or interaction that we just don't have for some reason in our communities, and with specific officers. I mean, it's not something that we say against all law enforcement. It's something that we say does exist. And it exists for one is too many, and it exists for too many officers, too many situations. And so I think it is an important conversation, but I think the flip side of it is that's what I've known, you know, for as long as I can remember. I think what we don't know is who doesn't understand that this is a problem. And that's where we do talk to those that aren't of color. And we talk to our white coworkers and our white friends and our white CEOs and our white bosses and our white teammates about that fear. So they understand it's not a matter of, you know, you should be in our shoes and you should feel what we feel. We don't want that. I'm not asking for anyone to go through that. What I'm asking for is you to understand and acknowledge that that's a real issue. And if you can acknowledge that, we can start having those conversations about where it exists, because the education is, it has to exist. In your families, they need to know that it's a problem. And your friends, they need to know that it's a problem. And then we can start figuring out, well, how do we solve it? And how do we deal with it? And how do we correct it? And how do we police it? And how do we understand it better? But we first have to acknowledge it. And that's all I've been trying to do is be somewhat of a conduit in helping others join in that conversation, because I'm a head coach. I have a platform. There's a lot of other head coaches. They have a platform, and we're trying to form this committee and this group and be unified in how we deliver that message to our NBA cities and our fan base, to our players, to our owners, and everyone else that'll listen.
You got that right, Coach. And me personally, I've had some of my white friends call me, as we can say, they understand that, or had me to explain to them my perspective on how this operates. And so just be able to talk to my white friends and white coworkers in the radio business and be able to explain to them how I've had to live for 33 years of my life and you 44 years. And I think it's been a great week. There's been some pushback from some of my white friends who have certain biases, but for the most part, Coach, they've been open and receptive to our message of this is how we feel. It's what we felt for years. And I think seeing George Floyd later for 9 minutes almost with a knee in his neck finally made him realize, hey, this is a problem, and we can help solve the problem, because we're only blacks, only 10% of this nation. We need, like Steve Kerr said, it's a white people problem to a degree, to help us make this change to be better going forward in 2020 and beyond.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. And I think it's a feeling that we all, and a question that we all have to ask ourselves. If you haven't had the conversation with someone and you're afraid to have the conversation with someone and someone's afraid to have it with you, well, you know where the problem is. It's the admittance of it. It's the understanding of it. And you know, until we can have that conversation, it's going to be hard to create any kind of change. And it's not an easy conversation. I'm not saying that, you know, all white people to just come out and start talking about the fact that there is racial discrimination. I think it's just really understanding that it's there and understanding, you know, of others' opinions and feelings and thoughts and beliefs. And, you know, for those that don't acknowledge it yet, you know, we still have a long way to go. And there's so many things that we're all searching for as to how we can find solutions to that. But I still believe we really have to acknowledge that there's an origin of this problem and how it started and why it's become this. But it hasn't gone away. We haven't had a solution to this for as long as I know. And so we really just need to get back to the origin and acknowledge that this has been a problem for a long time. We just happen to all see it live and on camera June or May 25th or whatever that last Monday was.
Most definitely, Coach. And I'll admit to you, this personally, Coach, here in Nashville, I'm afraid to go to certain parts of town still. And I'm in my 30s, Coach. No lie. A certain part of town here, I won't go into because I know what could happen to me. And I shouldn't feel that way 2020. But, of course, you and I both know the reality of the situation is. So I feel like explaining that to my white friends and coworkers has been – revealed into them that, wow, they didn't know that I felt that I can't go to certain parts of town, certain suburbs I shouldn't be in past dark because I'll get over and ask, why am I here? You know, not the fact that I'm here to help the community, but why are you out here anyway? So I think this week has been very good for a lot of people, but some people will need some more time. But I think what you got was doing the NBA Coaches Association with Stan Van Gundy, who I heard you talk about this other day as well, and Dre Popovich and Steve Kerr, you guys are doing a great thing using a platform to help spark a change in this country that we needed so for so long already, your coach.
No, and I appreciate it. I think it's a tremendous job from you as well, by being willing to speak about this and have this on your show and continue to educate others. And the more we can have these conversations, the better.
Most definitely, Coach. I want to talk to you about the team some, man. I read a report earlier here in the last hour that Al Silver wants to only do 22 teams, which means the Hawks are probably done for the year. And I know I heard you say that your team needs to play, and I agree with you. You need to get those guys more experience in game action. So what will be your plan of action going forward to help your young core, your core five there grow and improve, knowing that, hey, the season's over, summer league probably is not going to happen now, and what will be the plan going forward for you and your core five guys going forward?
Well, it's all of our guys. You know, it's our entire organization. It's the commitment to what we can do to get better. And, you know, game experience is the ultimate, but that doesn't mean we'd have to stop. We have to get in the weight room. We have to get stronger. We have to get in better condition with how we treat our bodies and that long-term aspect of really being diligent with what we do to get better physically. But we'll find ways. You know, that one setback isn't going to hold us off. You know, we've been out away from basketball for a while, and it's affected everyone in our league. But for us, you know, we go back to the drawing boards and we're still aimed at not skipping any steps, which means we've got to work on player development, work on our bodies, stay in the gym, and we'll continue to grow as a group. So it would be unfortunate if we don't make it to Orlando. It won't be the end of the world. We'll continue to work.
And, Coach, how have you guys kind of approached the whole pandemic with the guys not being away from you guys? The facility just opened up recently here after the governor opened Georgia back up. So how's it been kind of keeping guys mentally healthy as well as physically healthy with the pandemic and things going on in that regard?
You know, it's the same as everyone else. You know, trying to stay in contact as best you can. You know, obviously using Zoom for team meetings, creating dialogue, not just on basketball, really not about a lot of basketball at all. Just creating dialogue, keeping that connection, that chemistry with one another, you know, and finding other ways to stay connected. I think, you know, big part of team is understanding who you're fighting with, who you're working with, and caring for that other person and caring for your teammate. That's if you really, truly want to be a good teammate, it's about the others. And, you know, the Zoom meetings, the pandemic, the time away has allowed us an opportunity to stay connected, stay in communication with each other, and just focus on that aspect of our team building.
And, Coach, we're here in Tennessee here. You coach with the Memphis Grizzlies and down there in Memphis. So talk to us about your experience down there at the Grizzlies and how it was being on Coach Lionel Hollins and the gritty and grind and how the grind house was popping back then, Coach, as they say down in Bluff City down there.
Yeah, I mean, an unbelievable time, the two seasons under Coach Hollins. You know, you know, everything that he did for that organization and that city should be commended. You know, we ended up leaving in that last year after making it to the Western Conference Finals. But, you know, he was one of the more instrumental guys in my career because of his passion for that city, because of the wife that he and his, because of the work that he and his wife Angie did in that city with the Lady Grizz organization and the community efforts that Lionel did. You know, he really bought into the grit and grind aspects of the team, but he really bought into the grit and grind aspects of, as a head coach in a major city and really trying to uplift and build that city. So I was more impressed, you know, being in Memphis under Lionel's tutelage and the commitment that he showed for that city of Memphis.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, it was always good to drive down there and see those guys play. Or, you know, I'd be up I-40 late night going from Nashville to Memphis after the games, man, seeing you guys play back in those days, my early days of radio, man, grinding out there hard, seeing what I do with you guys with the Hawks, man. And, you know, I love what you all did down there for that city and that team, you know, because that city really loves their team. They love that Grizzlies so much down there. And that's the passion they have for that team was one of a kind, in my opinion, Coach.
Yeah, no, it's an unbelievable group. Mike Conley and Tony Allen, Zach and Rudy and OJ, you know, a lot of guys that came in and gave their all and had probably some of their best years there in the city. It was a great time to be part of the Grizzly and the Grizzlies organization.
And, Coach, you coached one of my buddies, Robert Covington, with the Sixers, who went to TSU, my alma mater here in Nashville. Speak about Robert Covington, his development as a player, and what he meant to you when you worked with him in your time in Philadelphia there.
Yeah, I mean, great story for a guy who really had to work his way into the NBA. I believe he was undrafted, you know, one of those in-between position guys, but, you know, true character, true testament to his work ethic. You know, was able to get picked up by Houston, the Houston Rockets organization. We were able to pick him up and sign him to an extension and a long-term deal in his first go-round, and then really get him a major payday in his second go-round with Philly. And, you know, you've seen he's been an all-defensive player. He's moved a little bit, but he's a very valuable 3-and-D type of player in our league, and that's where our league is. And so Rob's in a great position down in Houston, and we're looking forward to seeing him again when the season resumes.
Well, Coach Pierce, thank you for your time today, Coach. Best luck to you. I'm so happy for you, job doing with the Atlanta Hawks. I'll also be anytime we coach. The Hawks are my favorite team. I know I shouldn't be biased, but you all have my favorite team. You know, from being in Nashville, I just come down and see you guys at the Omni play. So I've been a Hawks fan since I was a child. So getting to cover you guys and talk to you and your players, man, it's a dream for me always. I see you guys when I come down there and cover the team, man.
No, I appreciate you having me on, and be safe, and good luck with the rest of the radio.
Thank you, Coach. Have a good one. Talk to you real soon, buddy.
Okay, thank you.
It's Lloyd Pierce on the Boss Man Show.
Till the tears run down from my eyes, Lord, somebody, ooh, somebody, can anybody find me somebody to love?
Alexa, play hits from Queen.
Okay.
Somebody to love.
With Amazon Music, a voice is all you need. Get tens of millions of songs. Download the Amazon Music app today.
All right, folks, back in the Boss Man Show here with my man, J.C. Smith, of the Essentialist F Podcast. They're doing big things over there, hosting on the Zoom platform. See him and his crew every week on YouTube. My man got his things going on, man. Bruh, how's it going with you and the crew, man?
Oh, man, what's going on, boss? Hey, everything's good, man. You know, we're still growing. You know, the show is still kind of in its infancy stage, if you will, man. So we're still growing, man. Still, you know, trying to make things bigger and better, man. We're trying to get on your level, man.
But, bro, man, how does it feel to be back in the media game again? I know you've been back on the show here for about 6 months or so, but how's it been getting back in the media game, hosting your own show now again?
Yeah, man, you know, I'm trying to get back, you know, get it, man, get on my grind with it. So it's been good. It's been good, man. It's kind of getting those creative juices, creative energy going again, man, like I used to have it back in the day, man. So that's good. So, you know, I just want to, you know, provide a platform where everybody can, you know, share their views and, you know, we have fun and be entertaining at the same time. You know how it goes.
No doubt. Well, bro, I know we had missed last week, the Memorial Day holiday, but let's talk about the Last Dance, man. The last episode of the actual Last Dance, bro. Were you shocked to find out it was a food poisoning game and not the flu game as was billed all this time?
It seems like, you know, throughout the years, you know, looking back at some of Michael Jordan's feats, and he almost took on like Paul Bunyan, John Henry type of feel, like a fable or something like that, you know, or something you would tell your kid, yeah, Michael Jordan played with the flu and all that. So, yeah, I was surprised to hear, because I remember hearing throughout the years it was either flu or he got sick, food poisoning. But the story they told was some bull, you know what I'm saying, as far as how it went down. I tend to subscribe to the notion that Mike probably stayed up drinking, smoked cigars all night, and ate the whole pizza by himself, and just naturally, you know, just probably ate too much and was just tired, you know what I'm saying, just tired, you know, from staying up and drinking all night. That's what I tend to believe now when I look back on probably what happened, man. Because I don't believe he got food poisoning, per se. I just think he ate too much and then add on smoking and drinking all night and staying up all night probably led to him just feeling, you know, just feeling bad to what he probably thought would be food poisoning. It might just be him just, you know, not feeling well. And I figured after eating all that food.
And they also said five guys delivered the pizza. Why would five guys even deliver one pizza, though?
Right. And you know, the guy who was the manager at that Pizza Hut where they ordered the pizza from, he called into a radio show in Utah and told the truth. He's like, no, it wasn't five people. It was just me and another guy. And that was it. So it was two guys that delivered the pizza, and they had no idea the pizza's for Jordan until they got to that floor. So, you know, it's your own documentary, so of course you're going to spin a story to make yourself, you know, look great. But I mean, Mike's the GOAT, but Mike a liar. Mike's a liar also, man. But he's a GOAT, man. At the end of the day, but he lied through most of this.
And they also said he liked to sit on his food because people would eat his food. He was real nasty about his food. He'll cough and spit all over his food. That just made my stomach turn when I heard him tell that story. It kind of made my stomach kind of turn a little bit when I heard it.
Yeah, Mike was an a-hole. when you sum it all up, man, like, he would do anything to win, and that's why we love him. But at the end of the day, man, you know, it would have been tough being Michael Jordan's teammate. You know, you want to either punch him, you know what I'm saying? Like, but you had to show that you were tough. You couldn't be no punk around Michael Jordan, man. But it would have been hard to be his teammate because Mike was very demanding, man. Maybe too much so, but, you know, that's why he got six rings, though.
No, definitely. And do you buy the story of Jerry Reinsdorf saying that, you know, that he talked to Phil and Michael about coming back for one more year? And I know Michael Jordan said, well, I would have came back on one-year contracts if you offered it to us. And if you ask people, it would have been the hardest one to kind of convince to do it. But if you give us the opportunity to try number seven, half of a year, in 1999, they could have probably did it. What were your thoughts on Mike's take and then Jerry Reinsdorf's kind of nothing burger answer about it when he was asked about it?
Yeah, I think, you know, for the longest time, we always felt like Jerry Krause, you know, was the one that ran them all off. And he had a contributing factor into it. But looking back on it, man, like, if you had to lay blame, or who has the most blame for the Bulls breaking up, I think Phil Jackson. I believe Phil Jackson should share a majority of that blame, man, because, like I said, you know, with Reinsdorf going to him, you know, at the last minute and offering him, you know, another year to come back, I think Phil, at that point, had enough. I think he had enough of working with Krause and, you know, was just, you know, tired and maybe just ready for a new challenge, or maybe needed a break. But I blame Phil Jackson for not giving MJ a heads up. Be like, hey, you know what? Reinsdorf came to him because Mike didn't even know about that, apparently, you know, until the documentary. So, you know, why not go to, you know, the man responsible for giving you all those rings? Why not go to him and be like, listen, man, hey, you know, Reinsdorf came to me for one more year, but I don't know, man. I'm not feeling it. You know, that way Mike at least would have an option to say, hey, you know what? maybe I can go play somewhere else because Phil's not coming back. Because, you know, Mike was always under contention. Look, if Phil Jackson's not my coach, I'm not coming back to play for the Bulls. But if Mike would have known that Phil, you know, declined the offer, then maybe that would change things. Michael Jordan, maybe he plays the following year somewhere. You know, so, you know, but I think Phil Jackson definitely should share most of that blame for the Bulls' breakup there.
And do you feel like the Michael Jordan idea of the one-year contract thing would have worked, come off that lockout, or no?
As far as them winning the championship?
Yeah, if they sign them all back to a one-year deal, bring them all back on one-year deals and try to go for number seven after that lockout.
Yeah, I think they make the finals that year. It was only a 50-game season.
Mm-hmm.
I believe they do make the finals. Do they beat the Spurs? That's going to be tough, man. You're talking about two twin towers, David Robinson and Tim Duncan, a young Tim Duncan who's just coming into his own there. They would have had a great chance, you know, but I still don't believe Scottie Pippen comes back. You know what I'm saying? Like, let's say if everybody signed up, let's come back one more year. I'm not sure Pippen comes back without the big money guarantee. You know, I couldn't see Pippen doing a one-year $5 million deal or something like that at the time. Like, because Pippen was ready to get paid, you know. And the Bulls did him a favor also by doing a sign and trade with Houston, allowing Sky to finally, you know, receive the big money they've been waiting on, you know, throughout his career there. So, they get to the finals if everybody comes back, but I'm not sure if they win 7-0.
I mean, I looked at it this was way, bro. Michael Jordan was gassed. Luke Longley was on his last legs. Dennis Rodman was on his last legs. Steve Kerr had a career as a bench player in San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
Jud Bushler was on his legs too. Ron Harper didn't hear him anymore. I mean, like, it sounds good on paper now, but I mean, truth be told, like we said previously, it ended it probably when it should. Because if they came back,
it all worked out. It all ended the way it was supposed to. It was glorious the way it ended, you know, with Mike hitting that last shot. That's the way it was supposed to, it was supposed to end and go out there. And like I said, I think Jerry Krause, you know, he had his faults, true enough. But I think he deserves more credit for what he built, what he helped to build, and for what he was trying to do. He was trying to go ahead, because I think he saw the writing on the wall and said, with the guys getting older, they still wanted to keep Michael, but everybody else was, exchangeable at that point, or dispensable. So he was trying to go ahead and rebuild. And if Krause would have had his way, the thing that he was trying to do, Krause was ahead of the game, man. He was trying to get a Tracy McGrady, you know, when Tracy was only, maybe a year or two into the league. He tried to trade for him in 97, you know. So, he was trying to go after McGrady. He was trying to get a Grant Hill. He was trying to go after Tim Duncan in 2000, man. Like, they was trying to build, you know, another super squad, you know, post-Michael Jordan. So, Krause, you know, deserves a lot of credit, man, for being, a step ahead of the game there, man.
And let's be honest about it. None of those guys, except Steve Kerr, was anything after they left that team.
Because
even Scottie Pippen's contract looked very bad real quick.
It did, man. I think, you know, that money was pretty much a thank you, you know, for all the years or whatever. But, yeah, at that point in career, Scotty should not have been making $18, $19, $20 million a year.
No doubt. And also, now, how do you feel that Michael Jordan did portraying his narrative? Because I feel like we've heard stories from Horace Grant and Scottie Pippen, how disappointed how Mike portrayed them in the documentary. And some of them pretty much see where he was lying about some stuff. He was stretching the truth about some stuff. So what are your thoughts on how Michael portrayed himself with Jason Hare and how Horace Grant and Scottie Pippen are clapping back at how they was portrayed in the documentary?
Well, I put it like this, man. Boss man, if you do a documentary about your life and your career, of course you're going to spin it, you know, to make yourself look great, right?
Most definitely.
Make yourself look good, or make yourself look better than anybody else, you know, that may be in the documentary. That's all Michael Jordan did, you know, basically. That's why he had creative control over it. You know, there wasn't going to be anything put out there that, you know, that he didn't get the final approval on. So, I think Mike, you know, actually, he looks great, but he looks bad also, all in the same light. I'm glad that he did put that stuff out there that made us kind of go question, you know, hey, what the hell is this? We never heard this before. You know what I'm saying? Or something that's going to put, he couldn't be out there to put him in a bad light. And then also some things that he was going to spin. You know, and that's just the way it goes anytime you have creative control over your own documentary. If Horace Grant and Scottie Pippen feel a certain type of way or feel things should have been talked about differently or they should have been viewed differently in documentary, then you know what, boss? They need to do their own documentary. Horace Grant needs to do his own documentary about his time with the Bulls. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you feel like Michael was lying, okay, well, let's hear your side. Let's hear your documentary. Scott, you feel like Mike did you wrong, made you look bad. Okay, let's hear your side. Let's see your documentary. That's really all you do in that situation is to wait for a story as opposed to letting somebody else tell the story for you.
Exactly. And I think, you know, really his beef with Michael Jordan kind of probably makes him go to the Magic even more, I guess. It probably pushed him to the Magic even more because of his beef with Michael Jordan and the Bulls organization, because he felt like he was a third wheel, which you were a third wheel, though, Horace. I mean,
right.
You come to Orlando, you're the third wheel, but I guess it's easier to still be Penny and Jack's third wheel than he is Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's weird,
yeah,
ain't it?
Yeah. And the Bulls thought, you know, he's expendable and decided not to renew his contract, man. That was a mistake. That was definitely a mistake, and you know that's why they tried to make good with getting Rodman, because they realized they missed a huge rebounding force with Horace Grant not being there. But yeah, man, like all you can do is tell your story, man. Can't nobody tell your story like you. So if you feel like somebody was doing you wrong or doing you dirty, or whatever, man, you got to put your story out there. But who wants to see a Horace Grant documentary?
Yeah, featuring Rick
Spicks. What's gonna be the title of it? They're gonna call it Goggles.
Rick Spicks. Right. Yes, Rick Spicks. That's what I got for you, boy. Similar to Orlando, this bubble thing is getting more and more traction. Trying to decide how many teams to bring. Is it bringing 16 or have a 20 team with the 9 through 12 season in the Western Conference, 24 teams or all 30 teams? What are your thoughts on the bubble? How many teams should come to the bubble in Orlando, come up here in late July or August here?
I mean, I wish they would just go straight to the playoffs. Normal 16-team format. However, they want to get Zion out there. They want to get Zion down there in the mix, because anytime Zion is out there, that's must-see TV. And they got to try to recoup, as much revenue as possible, from losing games, losing money over these last couple of months because of Corona. So I see what's going to end up happening in the next few days. I think there's going to be a 20-team playoff. I think there's going to be your 16 teams, and then there's going to be a play-in with the other four remaining Western Conference teams that are not currently in the playoff, because they got to get Zion in. Is it fair? No, but I understand it from a business standpoint. You got to try to recoup your losses, and Zion is the perfect player to do that for you, man. You got LeBron, you got all your other stars, but Zion, man, he's must-see TV when he's out there, when he's healthy and doing things, man. So I think at the end of the day, man, it's going to be a 20-team playoff that we're going to hear them announce next few days here. And then there's going to be a play-in for Sacramento, Portland, San Antonio, and New Orleans to get into the playoffs.
Well, I've kind of been unofficially told the Hawks are done for the year, which I'm actually okay with. It's kind of like the whole, we're not telling you, but we're telling you we're done for the year kind of thing. So I know it won't be all 30. It's somewhere between 24 and 16, exactly. And probably up at 20, as you see it. The four Western Conference team, 9 through 12 there. But thankfully for the Hawks, they are not going to lose any draft picks, so the draft out or anything, because they're all flat now, so I'm happy about that. So good that we're over. No more tanking for this year, thankfully. I don't want to go to Orlando anyway. Risk the virus either. So I'm kind of good with all the way around.
Exactly.
Well, bro.
Yeah, man. And, Orlando, at least Orlando gets home court advantage now. How about that?
Exactly. Exactly.
the Magic got home court
now. Yes, throughout the playoffs, right? Yes, indeed. Well, bro, hey, great job on the sports support, man. We'll talk to you next week, brothers. Be safe out there, man. Have a great show this week, man, on the Essential at Elf podcast, my brother.
All right, my guy. Appreciate you, boss.
Anytime, bro. JT Smith on the Boss Angel, people.
Yes, sir. Did you hear the news? Metro PCS is now Metro by T-Mobile. Now you get new plans with unlimited high-speed data all month long.
all on the T-Mobile network. Check out the new Metro by T-Mobile today and discover the smarter way to get unlimited. Metro by T-Mobile. That's genius. During congestion, the fraction of customers using greater than 35 gigs per month may notice reduced speeds. And Metro customers may notice reduced speeds versus some T-Mobile customers. Video streams at 480p. Coverage not available in some areas. See store for details and terms and conditions.
All right, folks, back in the Boss Man Show. Time for the Boss Report. This week's Boss Report, our man, Jesse Smith here. Bone still out with a personal issue. We're going to discuss George Floyd, the killing of him, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and other black people who got killed protesting even. And about experiences of black males in America and how now it's come to the forefront of how what we've been saying all this time is now coming to people's light for the first time, and they're right there at the front doorstep. So, I'm Jay Smith of Memphis. Bro, how you doing, man?
Boss, what you doing, man? What's going on?
Man, not much, bro. I just want to use our platform this week, man, to kind of educate our listener and audience and others around the world, man, about the trials and tribulations of being a black man in America. Let's start off with you, JC, man. I know you're from Houston, been in Memphis for a good long while, man. Tell the people about how what your walk is daily, how you move, kind of make sure that you don't have one of these negative outcomes that happened to George Floyd with the police department in Memphis there.
That's a very broad spectrum as far as the question. Because it's complicated as well, that man, because, the things that we wake up to, and we have to deal with on a daily basis is unique because not too many other races of people, or men that have to go through this, man, as far as how we talk, how we conduct ourselves at work and, if we do get pulled over, as far as the things that we have to kind of go through in our mind, like a checklist almost that we have to go through that, white guys, don't have to worry about as much. So, it's a very complicated question. And, it's just the thing that we have to deal with as black men. And it's sad when you think about it, that we have to go through that mental checklist every day, before we start our day, but that's just a, the trials and tribulations, like you said, of living, being black in America.
And I'll just say for me, living in the suburbs of Atlanta, it's not many blacks out my way. So I move a little differently. I kind of move with a slow pace, keeping my head on a swivel, looking over my shoulder at all times, and I try to limit contact with people to begin with. You know what I'm saying? Because you never know when that whiteness might be weaponized against you. You know what I'm saying? The same way it was with New York with that young, with Amy Moore, whatever her name was, with the man in bird watching guy in New York City, man, hell, even Emmett Till, weaponizing whiteness. Chris, remember that girl, Christine Leahy and LeVar Ball, he was like, I ain't talking to you. Like, it's those examples right there of weaponizing whiteness against the black man that makes you just be like, man, let me just move with a kind of a slow bop, like bro, man, almost. Let me just kind of move it slow because I don't want to be another number or a hashtag or a stat.
Yeah, I'll tell you something else, man, that, has always been a thought in my mind. Like, if I'm walking, on the street, and let's say it's a white woman or something like that, holding a purse, what I'm saying? Like, in my mind, I'm thinking, if I walk by this white woman first, is she going to make eye-to-eye contact with me? Is she going to acknowledge me? Secondly, is she going to try to clutch her purse as if, I would try to, jack her for it or something. It's just things like that, I constantly always think about. Like, if I'm in the elevator with somebody white, it's always something in my mind, man, where, it feels like we have to kind of go out of our way to make them feel comfortable almost. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Because we're looked at as intimidating or as threats.
Right.
Or some people, they're terrorists, or we're just nasty, bad people.
Yeah. Exactly, man. It's tragic. It's sad, man. But it's just the way I think we've always kind of been built and conditioned throughout the years, is to not make ourselves, like I said, less imposing or intimidating, less intimidating as possible. In order for us to be able to conduct and, and thrive in this world we live in. And, like I said, it's sad, and I hope, we get to a point where,
you know, that's not going to be the standard or the definition of being black in America, you know, for our future sake, your kids' sake.
Yeah, and you have a son that's growing up. I know you're probably giving him the talks about how to deal with the police and what he's like to be a black man in America, because your son is only going to know from you, you know, and he's going to learn for himself when he gets older. But how has it been a parent to have an educated young black male on how to move in this world as he gets older and navigates life?
You know, and my son, it's a great question, boss. My son, he's a lot like me at that age, kind of precocious and naive to the world, you know, and not really having to experience anything yet, as of yet. But, you know, the way this world is going, I would be remiss at this point if I didn't have a discussion with him. We talked about it. He wasn't down. He knew about Ahmaud Arbery's death, but he didn't know about George Floyd. So I sat him down. I talked to him over this past weekend about it. And I asked him, like, you know, what would you do if you're stopped, you know, by the police, you know, when you get older? And I kind of gave him that checklist, you know, as far as what to do. And, you know, like I said, that's a conversation that, you know, my white counterparts don't have to have with their children. You know, Asians don't have to really have that conversation with their children. Mexican parents, maybe, but...
they do.
You know, this is something... Yeah. You know, but this is something that seems like it's built, you know, exclusively for us to have conversations with our children, you know, just to make sure. And because it comes in handy. Because my mom and dad had the conversation with me to where, you know, yes, sir, no, sir, when you talk to police, you know, both hands on steering wheel, turn your music down. You know, just stuff like that, man. And like I said, you're going to get tried with it, though, because you're going to get pulled over at some point being black for no reason whatsoever. I've had plenty of experiences in Texas like that where, you know, it could have gone south if I didn't have that checklist in mind and how to speak. I just have, you know, proper respect for people. And just showing that proper respect, that kind of reflects, and you kind of, in my case, you're able to kind of get that back from police officers. But, you know, in other cases, you see, as we all know, it's been documented, you know, in certain cases, that's not always, you know, what happens.
Speaking of police here in Atlanta, Saturday night, they dragged out two kids from, one from Spelman, one from Morehouse, trying to get back home before when the curfew hit. And five or six cops involved were black. And I made this point to people that whether it's a black or white cop, they see blue. That race is called blue.
And
the black cops will put on more to impress their white counterparts, so that they're down for Team Blue and not Team Black. And so that's why... When I talk here about community policing or where I need more black cops, no. I've had my experience with black cops trying to put on and show out for their white counterparts. So it's Team Blue. A black officer may give you red, may not, but depending on their mood that day. But ultimately, they're Team Blue.
Yeah, and that's the worst kind of police, like you said, black officer, like I said, trying to show out for his white officer, counterparts there. That definitely makes the situation even worse. And like I said, the Atlanta situation, that was a situation where it was just so unnecessary. You know what I'm saying? It didn't take all that, you know, for them to do that. You know, it made a situation and probably scared the hell out of those two children. That's two children. They're going to get paid, of course, but... They traumatized. It's probably going to be scarred for life now, man.
They all scarred for life.
You know, like I said, Morehouse, Spelman, I'm talking about, you know, two of the elite, you know, HBCUs in the country and you know, historically known as far as prestige in Atlanta. And you're going to do that to them? You know what I'm saying? Like, for no reason, really, you know. They were trying to abide by the law, trying to get out, you know, of the area or whatever. It was just so unnecessary to force, man. And that's the microcosm of police in general. That's the problem. You know, the fact that they're using such unnecessary force for a minor infraction. You know what I'm saying? A minor situation. Why does it take so much force for that, man? And the cops deserve to get fired. And, you know, I would hope criminal, action would be taken against those officers as well.
They've been charged.
Yeah.
They've been charged, and they deserve to be charged.
Good,
but,
good.
Yeah. But I will say this, it's not popular opinion, but the mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms, is responsible for it too, and the chief, Erica Shields, because they overreacted and did the curfew. They sicked them on them people. You gave them reason. All they want is a reason to act the fool, and you gave them a reason to act the fool.
You're right. You're right. You know, like you know better than me as far as what Mayor Keisha, you know, the work she's been doing down there. You know, from afar, I seem like she has been doing a pretty decent job as mayor of Atlanta. But I think in that situation, you know, when she was doing the press conference and, you know, it was a serious situation. And, of course, you don't want folks to loot and riot and tear up the city. However, like you say, I do believe her actions, you know, by doing that, it did kind of give police a green light to basically, you know, feel like they had, you know, complete autonomy or authority to, you know, crack heads or bust heads, you know what I'm saying, to make sure that, you know, law was restored or whatever in the city. And like I said, it probably didn't enable those officers to feel like they had the authority to do that those 4 years, man.
And the chief, Erica Shields, said that she believed that the officers maybe went overboard, but it wasn't worthy of charging them for it. That's what their chief said.
Wow. Yeah. So, like I said, it's the culture. That's the culture that, you know, we've been dealing with forever, man. And like you said, you know, pray to God and we hope that, you know, these charges, you know, as far as the trial for Ahmaud, the trial for Floyd, that, you know, these charges will stick and these officers will do serious officers and then also the two guys who killed Ahmaud, they'll do serious time, man. And that's the only way that we'll be able to kind of get this thing going in the right direction, man. We gotta hold these officers accountable. And then once they see that, hey, you cannot get away with killing unarmed black men anymore, you know, or women. And once they see that you will do serious time, then I think, like I said, we can finally maybe see some change there.
And I want to make one point about Atlanta with Drew Brees. Killer Mike need to keep his mouth shut. He's the same man that was last election talking about because Bernie Sanders didn't win. The nomination, don't vote. And then changes it, well, vote for Jill Stein. So you tell people not to go vote. So part of the reason we have this problem in the White House is your fault too. T.I. talking about Atlanta's Wakanda. Let's be honest about this, T.I. Most of your businesses on the West End, they're in very gentrified areas of Atlanta, okay? You live in Henry County, in suburbs where I do. You're not even see that much. You're out here where I'm at in the suburbs, okay? Let's stop that too. And Shekinah crying about the Gucci store, bruh. Y'all looting the Gucci store! What?
Yeah.
Like, bro, I want us as black people to quit following celebrities. Like, seriously. Our black celebrities do not determine our lives. You and I are middle class people, JC. So a lot of people are in our shoes. If you hold your vote for Joe Biden this year, if you're Diddy, or if you're Charmaine the God, or Killer Mike, guess what? They're going to still be rich in the burbs, right? We out here struggling for our little scraps. So we about people need to quit letting celebrities dictate our lives. They live in their little plush, luxurious, gated communities in the burbs. What are your thoughts, brother?
All right, so to start with, all right, as far as Killer Mike, I like, all right, I think what happened with the whole Bernie Sanders thing, that's his friend. You know what I'm saying? Like, of course he, you know, rallies around, you know, supports Bernie, but I really think that him and Bernie have a real kinship, a real friendship there. So I think he took it personal, you know, as far as him, you know, saying not to vote after, you know, it was, you know, determined that Bernie wasn't going to win the nomination or anything like that. Killer Mike, I think Killer Mike at some point should run for office, you know, or something. Because the brother, he has an old soul, and he's able to elaborate on our conditions, and he's able to speak it to people who, you know, normally wouldn't be able to listen or hear, you know, where we're coming from. Killer Mike is a great a great delegate in that aspect. You know what I mean?
On some issues, not all, but some.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, if you saw his segment on Undisputed with Shannon and Skip, oh, man, Killer Mike, he killed it. You know what I'm saying? No pun intended. Like, he nailed it as far as, you know, the state of our country and everything that's going on and what it's going to take for, you know, for necessary change to happen. And I thought it was brilliant. And, you know, also, you speak of, you know, T.I. And all that as far as, you know, celebrities go. You know, we got to understand, you know, of course, their beliefs are not going to fall, like, they're not going to fall in line with us, you know, with middle Black America, you know, people working 9 to 5, because, you know, they're millionaires and they're capitalists, you know, at the end of the day. So, right. So, you know, their views is not, you know, they have a oneness with us, but their, you know, interest lies in how can they make money?
You know what I'm saying? Right.
So looters and rioters are, you know, messing up things on where they stay in or the places they shop. That's a problem, you know. So that's why I think Trina also messed up as well, you know, with her statements, you know, because she doesn't go through the everyday struggles that we go through, you know. So yeah, like I said, it's very complicated at the end of the day. But, you know, like I said, the T.I., the Killer Mike, the Trinas of the world, you know, they're with us, but they're not with us at the same time, if that makes sense.
T.I. lives 2 inches from me, man.
Yeah.
2 inches from me, bro.
Yeah.
He ain't in the city. He own property, yeah, but he ain't in the city.
Right. Exactly.
You know, exactly. Like, let's be, you know, real. Like, and...
Right. You know, I'm all about, you know, spending, you know, the Black dollar and, you know, us, you know, find a way to economically kind of sustain ourselves. But the problem has been always, okay, it benefits Jay-Z, it benefits T.I., but how does it benefit, you know, the everyday person? How does the dollar circulate? You know, that's the problem. Like, okay, we're going to spend with you, but how does it come back to us? You know, and that's what I think we have to kind of establish. We have to figure out, okay, we're going to do this. How is it going to benefit everybody? How can that dollar circulate to where if I spend money with you, it's going to come help me and the next person and the next person and the next person? That's been a problem. Like, we spend money, like, you know, like Nipsey had it down. Nipsey was the one that really understood it. You know, but the others, we just kind of find ways to make it benefit ourselves. Nipsey had a way it benefited him and also benefited the hood also at the same time. So that's what we got to kind of figure out. How can we get it to where it helps both parties?
And I'm going to say, tip down on Joe Biden, I'm going to go to Drew Brees. Joe Biden's right, bruh. If you vote for Donald Trump, you ain't Black. And I want to comment on Charlamagne the God, Ricky Smiley, and Jeff Johnson, Angela Wright, others who talk about Joe Biden, Big Daddy Joe Biden's black agenda. Go to his website, joebiden.com. There's one there for you. So if you have a platform in media, do your research before you open your mouths about certain things that you infiltrate our Black minds, give people the wrong idea, make people stay home and not vote. We should have one goal, bro. Get rid of 45. Get rid of Cheeto, man.
Yeah, you're right. And that should be any decent human person, any person that feels like, you know, everybody deserves respect, deserves just the basic decency, basic common sense of respecting your fellow person, should vote 45 out. You know, Black, white, Asian, if you just feel like, you know, you got love in your heart for everybody, everybody has issues, everybody has their problems, but at the end of the day, we have to come together as a race of people. Black, this is a human race, Black, white, whatever. And get people that like Trump and people that think like him, get them out of there. Get them out of the office and let's put in people like that really have an interest for us, really have a care for us and want to, you know, help their community, help, you know, just help us become better. And that's what we got to focus on, man. Like I said, if you voted for Trump in 2016 and you see the error in your ways now, man, I hope that you go out and you make amends to that wrong that you did 4 years ago.
Most definitely. I've already voted by mail here, and I'm looking forward to doing it again in November. And, bro, last story today on the Boss Report here is Drew Brees, man. Regurgitated his Trump right-wing talking point of that kneeling disrespect to the United States and the flag, bro. And he got dragged to hell yesterday, even by his own teammates. LeBron James hit him. Ed Reed hit him. He got hit from every which way. He gave some tepid apology with some passive-aggressive wording that, hey, that might was taken out of context, or I didn't mean to express it that way. You know how the PR firm does. His thoughts ain't changed in one day, bro. He's just trying to get this little over fast as he can.
You know, and I almost could respect Drew Brees more if he would have stuck to his guns. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You stick to your guns. That's like we know who you are. Be you. Like, keep that same energy, Playboy. Don't switch up 24 hours later. You know, because we tried to tell you back in 2016 or 2017 what Kaepernick was doing was not about disrespecting the flag, you know? And now 4 years later, you know, or a week after, we witnessed the Minnesota police basically publicly lynch a black man on the street. You still want to keep that same that same talking point, huh? That same agenda, basically, and think that it's about the flag, about the country. No, it's not, it has nothing to do with the flag. We're talking about police brutality. We're talking about racism. We're talking about America. It has nothing to do with your grandfather fought in the World War II. Hell, my grandfather's, my family, your boss man, your family, any black person's family, they have traced their ties back to the military and serving in the war. So your grandfather's not more special than ours. You know what I'm saying? And then ours was treated way worse when they came back home than your Drew Brees people. You know what I'm saying? Our forefathers, ancestors, grandfathers served in segregated armies. And when they came back home, they were treated, probably treated worse than when they left. You know what I'm saying? So it's, like I said, Drew Brees, he deserves to get dragged by his teammates, by other athletes, because it was just so stupid, so insensitive. And like I said, I'm not saying Drew Brees is a bad guy. You know, we know his charitable work and everything, but when it gets down
tax
to
tax write off, brother, tax write off.
Right, exactly. It's free. Yeah, probably so. You know, but when it gets right down to it, we see you now because. Mm-hmm. You have 4 years to change your heart, to change your mind about it. But no, you didn't. You didn't, man. And like I said, we see who you are now. We know who you are. Keep that same energy, man. Like I said, because this is at a point now in our country, there is no gray area. There's no middle area.
It sure is.
You either over here with us or you're over there with them. Us or them. We know that Drew Brees is over there with them in his heart. And if you're a teammate like Malcolm Jenkins was last night, you know, that man was in tears. You're talking about a grown man in tears over what his teammate, a man that he probably respected, you know, before all of this, you know, in tears over what Drew Brees had to say. And also, you know, Michael Thomas and Emmanuel Sanders tweeting out, you know, in regards to Drew Brees and their contention with what he had to say. And these are people that Drew Brees has to play with next year.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, hey, man, if you're a Saints fan, you're a Drew Brees fan, I mean, especially if you're an African-American and you're a Brees fan, or you were a Brees fan or Saints fan, you really have to kind of rethink your position now, man.
Oh,
at this point. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And you know what? His first thoughts were his real thoughts. This was a PR spin today. First thoughts were his real thoughts. And those guys they're never going to look him the same ever again. He lost the locker room already. They're done.
Yeah.
Forever.
Yeah, because basically what you did, you doubled down after 4 years of everything that has happened and transpired up until the moment he said that last night. You basically doubled down on what you said in 2016 and 2017. That's really all you did, man. Because like I said, we know you ride with Team Trump. You're a Republican. Conservative. Cool. Just keep that same energy, man. And it's gonna be a hit on his legacy when it's all said and done, because Colin Kaepernick, man, think about how he's looked at now as opposed to 3 years ago when all this first started.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Colin Kaepernick is now a popular figure. You know what I'm saying? As opposed to reviled and hated, you know, when he was first taking that unpopular stance, you know, in America's opinion. Now look at him, man. He's basically on track to be kind of a Muhammad Ali type status.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. It took 4 years, but now he's proven to be right, and now Drew Brees is on the wrong side of history now. Who would have thought?
Yeah, there it is.
Four years ago.
The wrong side of history. That's exactly how it is, man. That's going to be a hit. As great, you know, number one rated passer when it comes to stats, numbers of all time, you know, as far as his numbers and everything goes. But off the field, hey, it's definitely going to be a hit, a stain on his legacy, man, when it's all said and done.
Most definitely. With JC, my brother, thank you for your time this week. Before you go, tell people about your show, man. This essentially is AF Podcast. What you got going this week, brother? I know you're going to be hitting this topic as well, probably.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We're definitely going to revisit, you know, everything that's been going on this week and give our take, you know, how we feel about everything that's happening in our country. We're going to dive into all of it. Essential AF Podcast. You can find us on YouTube. We go live on Facebook each and every Sunday, starting at 6 o'clock on each and every Sunday evening, man. But make sure you like, make sure you share, make sure you go subscribe to our YouTube channel, hashtag Essential AF Podcast.
JC, my brother, thank you for this, man. I want you to do this ball support today for good. We can take a week off from the crazy stories just to talk about something real in real life, and I'm glad to do it with you, my brother. I'll talk to you next week, man. I hope you feel better, man. I hope you stay safe in Memphis, brother.
Boss, hey, man, you keep doing what you're doing, bro. I appreciate you, man. You fight the good fight. And, you know, I'm just happy I can go along for the ride, on the ride with you, man.
No doubt, folks. This has been the Boss Report Special Edition here with JC's Inbox, man. We are out.